a shot in the dark. Wary sort of spark. I'm a light that's too bright for me to see.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right, kids, episode 277. You know what? A note of numerical sequential housekeeping here. It was brought to my attention by the lovely and talented and yet still, regardless of all evidence, Pokemon obsessed Jennifer Longworth, that my producer, that I skipped 274 evidently. So, you know, in my defense, I make the caveat every time that I have no idea what number we're on. So I'm always within one or two. It's kind of like the way I am with wine tasting, blind. I can usually get within a vintage or two if it's American and it's from the last, 10 years or so. And I've got a good reason. If I'm off, I got a good reason for thinking I'm off. Actually, my palate has gone to HE double hockey stick and a ham basket, and I couldn't probably name a vintage if you put a gun in my head. But that's neither here nor there. Hold on, I need coffee. Ladies and gentlemen, we have an early morning show today. Gosh, I tell you what, this week is just one of those weeks where it's like I have so many deadlines and so much stuff to get done for Calyx, my apostolate. Lots of amazing and interesting stuff happening with Calyx. Most of it slightly on the DL still, but big announcements coming. Very excited. But I just hate that I came in, worked a day job, recorded a show, then worked a day job, and then, at last night had to work on a proposal and stuff. And I feel like I just left here. I did kind of just leave here, but I wasn't taking any chances last night. I decided to, not very often do I use something to help me go to sleep, but last night it was, I took one of those, like the Tylenol PM without the Tylenol in it. I wish I'd have had with the Tylenol in it. My knee hurt last night, but, yes, I took one of those, like, knock me out, and it knocked me out. So it did a good job. So, all right, so here we go. Early morning edition. Let's see. Okay, so I did an interview, totally impromptu interview yesterday. It was so fun. I love Paul McCusker. If you didn't listen to 276, go back and listen to it. Paul is just a really intelligent person that I love to pieces, and who just always has something thoughtful and mindful to say about kind of what's going on. And he's not afraid to have, definite opinions. He's not afraid to explore things with nuance and admit that he doesn't know something. And I appreciate people like that. And so it's funny. I started the over-the-counter podcast with Mark Giesecheck because, we were just always having such interesting conversations, quite literally over the counter of the coffee bar. If I didn't have this show, I think I would have already started another podcast with Paul, or I would have drug Paul into me and Mark's podcast, Mark and I's podcast. Yeah, I've given up on the idea that I will ever sound like I had a good primary education. All right. So, yesterday I was just literally setting up my gear to record, and I'd kind of gotten banished to a different conference room to use as my little studio. And in walks Paul and sits down, starts talking to me while I'm literally, putting cords and mics and setting gear up and everything. And, and at some point I was just like, Paul, I have 50 minutes to get this show done, you need to either shut up, leave, or take a microphone. Those are your options. And so he's like, all right, whatever you want to do, man. I'm like, here's a mic. Let's talk. So I love that spontaneous thing, because this show is called The Counterposition. If you didn't know, I'm not trying to be contrarian. It's a play on words. It's my take on the world from my position in the world, which for the last 23, 24 years has been behind the counter, mostly of coffee houses, occasionally wine bars. And so that kind of free, easy, kind of like leisurely kind of conversation where there's no real end point and there's no real direction it has to go. And rabbit trails are welcome. And I, you know, Paul brought something up yesterday that I think is pretty interesting, is that he and I are the type of people that consider conversation a hobby. And I'd never thought about it like that, but it's true. I mean, I consider just going to a coffee house, getting a cup, and just having a conversation with a random human being about something with no agenda and just seeing where it goes. That is, I do that the way other people would, like, watch a movie or read a book for a while or something. And it's, I do watch movies and I do read books. I buy books more than I read books, but I do read books. all right. So, but my impromptu interview got in the way of me doing the weekly recap, the weekend recap. Duh, duh, duh. I need some like theme music for the weekend recap. Something like very David Letterman-ish, you know, is there any way we could get Paul and like a band in here? That'd be great. So if you listen to 275, because I skipped 274, I was about to go into a reading group, and I want to talk a little bit about this reading group. So me and Adam, I almost got shot by Wendelberry Beach, and Zach, this NASA space plumber, Candler, and Andrew Beach, Adam's little brother. And God, what's it? Jared Stout, professor about town, liberally educated, forced to be reckoned with. And what's the other guy's name? Matt, I think it is. I just met him for the first time. He's the founder of, I think, Catholic urban farming thing in Denver here. Really young guy, really smart. It seems like he's read everything under the sun and remembers it. I remember when I used to be able to remember what I read. so we're doing an integral ecology reading group, and I'm kind of behind on it because I've been traveling a lot, and they met once or twice while I was out of town. But so far the group has done Laudato Si, and they've done some Wendell Berry, and I think there was a Vaclav Havel essay going around, but it wasn't discussed. So I got a little catch up to do. Next, I'm not sure where we're going next exactly. I think more Wendell Berry, but I tell you what, looking at the big picture of creation and the very particular experience of a piece of land, of a context, of a place, and seeing that as productive and all the ramifications of that in between for life and family and sexuality and economics and the ecology and all this stuff is just fascinating. It's a realm that I hadn't read a lot in, and I find myself, mostly because of my involvement with some projects in Flint, Michigan, just going back to it over and over again. And I tell you what, Wendell Berry is like the undiscovered treasure in my world. Every once in a while I find a writer that I just can't get enough of, and the last one was Ratzinger, because I'd read so much JP2 that I just hadn't read much Ratzinger. And then now it's like Wendell Berry is the guy. I mean, he's totally different thing, totally different level. He's not really, properly speaking, a theologian. But it's funny, he calls himself a back row Baptist. And for a back row Baptist, he's pretty much a natural Thomist. So it's fun. So I'm really enjoying that reading group. Saturday night was, well, so a week ago, today was Jim Ducky Lawrence's 40th birthday. So yet another birthday shout out to my boy Ducky. But this last Saturday night, we had a party for the Lord Duck there. And And so Jonathan Gailey, a friend of ours over in Communion and Liberation, was having a birthday party the same night, and we were inviting. It turns out that like our invite list was like 70% the same. And so at the last minute, I got out of hosting a party at my house, and we all ended up going to Jonathan's, which was kind of I was pretty tired from a rough week, and I was not really in the mood to host a big giant party at the house. So I was kind of happy to see it get moved. And there was people that I kind of probably wouldn't have seen that I saw at that party that was really great. And I managed to snag Chris Special Treat Stefanik and his absolutely lovely and amazing bride Nat after the Beacon of Hope Gala to come over. So they came and hung out for a little while. And it's not easy to get that cat to come out to a random party. He's got a ton of kids and he's super busy, but the fates worked it out and he was down the street. So it was good to hang out. And so Ducky and Stefanik went to college together and were in the same household. So that was a great surprise. And I love spending time with Chris and Nat. I just love those people so much. Such amazing folks. And then I spent the rest of the weekend thinking through still working on Shrine Coffee out in Santa Cruz, California. We're really kind of looks like that's going to go forward. I mean, there's been a couple of stalls, but it's kind of happening. And so I was just thinking through the hard numbers. And I'm just not a math guy, but it's interesting really thinking through like payroll and markups and all this is a way to kind of really enter in through imagination into the life of a business and the experience on the ground of a business. And it's the kind of math I enjoy, looking at the kind of the big picture strategic math and thinking about what that means for human beings on the ground. Yeah. So that's what I did this weekend. I went to church. That sounded so anticlimactic. And the living God became incarnate and I consumed him. Let's go to the break. You're listening to the Gouter Position.
I'm a sacred word to mutter. Ran too fast and turned to butter. I'm a bit too much for me to chew.
If you enjoy listening to Andrew Whaley on The Counterposition, you should become a friend of the show. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show to provide your support. Thank you.
I'm a skip across the pond. I'm an ocean on and on. I'm a fish with no bowl that I outgrew. Lift my blood. Only one on track.
Welcome back to The Counter Position. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right, ladies and gentlemen, ladies and jelly spoons. so I like as I go to the break, I'm just like, oh yeah, and I went to church. I am so Catholic, man. I'm telling you, in the best sense of the word and in the worst sense of the word. It's like I kind of take for granted that, you know, the second person of the Holy Trinity became incarnate and in his continuing incarnation made himself present to me under the auspices of bread and wine by becoming the body and blood, soul and divinity of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ for me to consume and become a partaker, participate and become partaker in the divine nature. Yeah. Yeah. Yada, yada, yada. You know, that kind of thing. It's like, remember on Seinfeld when they had, there was one of the themes in one of the episodes was you can't yada, yada, yada sex. It's like, you know, we went and got dinner. You know, we went and saw a movie, went and got some dinner, had some coffee and some dessert. We went back to the house, had a nightcap, and, you know, yada, yada, yada. He's like, no, you can't yada, yada, yada. You know, and they had this giant argument about whether or not you can yada, yada, yada if yada, yada, yada includes sex, right? Well, if you can't yada, yada, yada sex, you sure as heck can't yada, yada, yada the second person of the Trinity becoming incarnate under the auspices of bread and wine. Which is a continuation of that nuptial metaphor, is it not, dude? This is what happens. You see what happens, Andrew? This is what happens when I do an early morning show. I end up comparing the Eucharist to Seinfeld. And yeah. All right, a little coffee sip. All right, so, man, okay. So, I made a note to myself yesterday to talk about this. So, I just want to talk about this segment, and I'm going to try to keep it to one segment. I want to talk about my political frustration. And I don't really mean even my political frustration. I mean my frustration with the role that the political is playing in my life. It seems like in this, I mean, and this has just been dialed to 11. It's been rampant towards this, but the moment Trump took office has just dialed like from 11 to 23. It's like Denver traffic. Either people are just two extremes. Either they're just going like 10, 15 miles an hour under the speed limit, and you're like, what are you doing? Or you look in your mirror, you're fine, you start to go, you almost get clipped because someone is coming through at 96 miles an hour in a 60. And you're just like, what in the world? I mean, it's like, that's how politics has become. I had no less than two or three people in 6-7 hours, maybe 4-5 hours yesterday, tell me that they had removed Facebook from their iPhones, took the Facebook off of their phones because they just couldn't do it anymore. One of my relatives I saw online say that in the last 2 days, the four people she has known plus 25 years have either defriended her or she's defriended them. I mean, it's amazing. It's like people walk in, you know, there's a guy that comes in my shop and he and I are on very different ends of the ideological spectrum. We've really carved out some middle ground. For him, it is just all about the environment. The only thing he cares about is he's really, 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 really bought the argument that we are about to destroy the context in which we live. And so everything needs to just be seen in that light. And if that were true, I would agree with him. I don't think that's true. I think we definitely are jacking the place up with pollution and everything. I tend to be when it comes to climate change, global warming, all that stuff. I tend to fall more on the bigger cyclical kind of a thing, which by the way, I'm going to do a segment or so pretty soon about the Amazon. Someone brought up this book and this article called 1491, which I guess there's a theory about the Amazon being cultivated, that turns out that what we see with this super rich biodiversity may have been basically a garden half the size of a continent, that there's an argument that there were way more people there and way more cultivation, and that they were killed off by disease from the being transferred from the initial explorers, and that the rebound of the Amazon being taken back over so quickly from everyone dying so fast and no longer cultivating it just sucks so much carbon out of the air that it caused the Little Ice Age, which is a huge theory. And I haven't read, but I haven't read the book yet. And I haven't read even the article. I'm going to read the article first. If I find it interesting enough, I think I'm going to buy the audio book and listen to the book in my car. It's called 1491. It's about what happened right before Columbus discovered America. And so I tend to think that you look at the this is kind of an aside. This is, people have asked me before, what do you think about the whole ecology, global warming and all that? I think that we know for a fact in the medieval period that it was dramatically warmer. We have the manuals from monks growing grapes in northern England that you now need to grow in the south of France. The Greenland Vikings and all that. There's Viking graves in Greenland that are under 6 feet of permafrost. and they didn't hack through 6 feet of permafrost to bury them. It was soft ground when they buried them. So we know that in the medieval period, there's a million different ways. It's a pretty accepted fact that it was a lot warmer in the medieval period. And then you see things, they call it the Little Ice Age. You read the accounts of Washington at Valley Forge and stuff like that. And it sounds crazy, but it really did go through a crazy trough. And we've been kind of coming out of that. So I think that now, whether or not some of the rebound from the Little Ice Age is anthropogenic. Oh, okay. Yeah. I mean, we are throwing a ton of carbon in the air, but whether or not we're the giant cause behind any kind of like change, whether there even is that much of a change, properly speaking, whether we're the cause of it, and whether or not that would be like a giant disaster. I mean, what I keep trying to figure out is like, why does everyone think that the world is going to be this giant disaster after we gain a few degrees, when it was warmer in the medieval period and it seemed like things were pretty friggin' awesome, you know, climate wise in the medieval period. Anyway, there's a big fat rabbit trail on what I think about climate change, but all right. But anyway, so this guy comes in the shop who's like all about climate change. I remember where I was going with this. And we're always talking about politics and everything. And he's like, and he comes in and he's just smiling this forced smile. Like he's just like the walking wounded, like he's got PTSD or something. And I'm like, hey, how you doing, man? And he smiles. He goes, work's good. It's just like people are walking around like in a state of shock, you know. My friend Andrew, who is like really, really on the other end of the ideological spectrum for me, he's a really, really, he's become an extremely serious liberal and has defriended friends of mine and stuff. And it's gotten a little toxic at times. I'm surprised I've made the cut, but and I love the guy to pieces. He's a really good human being that I adore, but we are just on very different pages. We see this world through very different lenses. And even he was like, man, I work from home. I don't have kids and I have friends who are journalists and I can't keep up with all this. And it's only week one. And it's like that I think that we're, in addition to just the toxic, divided, crazy nature of the current public life and political life, it's just the sheer volume of it. There's just so much of it. How do you try to sift through all this propaganda and, you know, this fake news thing that they start? I mean, I don't know how many times I've been seeing a friend of mine who's a really sharp human being, who's really an amazing person, and who is very open-minded and kind of thoughtful and careful about what she posts, posts an article. I don't read it, but I kind of see it as like, oh, well, man, she's got time to do this, and she's on top of that. So I can probably take that as kind of a fact. And then someone else is like, yeah, that was fake news. And they linked someplace to where that, you know, turns out that there are sites out there that look so much like real news and they're just literally making stuff up. I mean, we've just gotten into this weird disinformation society. And last night I literally had political nightmares last night. And I dreamt of like one of the major players getting kidnapped, then traded for one of the other players, and then that guy having a heart attack. And everybody was like cheering in the streets. This guy had a heart attack and the administration was like spinning it into like new guidelines for eating so that this wouldn't happen to other people. It's like bizarre dreams. Anyway, you're listening to The Counter Position. I am your host, Andrew Whaley.
Then how we crave a hanging in the dark.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
People singing, please don't stay, but please don't go.
Welcome back to The Counter Position. I am your plain old vanilla host. I don't feel very humble today. I never feel humble. When I say I'm your humble host, that is an act of faith. One of these days I'll be good enough to be humble. Probably not. But is that an act of humility? Yeah. I'm pretty humble, actually. I'm more humble than most people, you know. I mean, humility is one of my greatest virtues among all of them. All right. So, you know, I want to talk about, before we go, so I want to kind of pull back a little bit. So I'm not really, I've decided not to try to just, there's just no way for me to do just constant commentary. I'm seeing now that just the new political reality, the Trump reality, and the reaction to the Trump reality is, if I'm not careful, this show could turn into me just trying to be the Catholic Rush Limbaugh or something, or just like this political commentary all the time. And, you know, a close friend of mine said, you know, hey, if you really wanted to go that direction, I mean, you could kind of become that. And I think you got more to give than that, so don't become that. And I think that's true. I think that I have a chance with this show and my take on reality to do something that might be a little different. I mean, I want to hit politics. I want to talk about politics. I'm more interested in the way putting politics in light of bigger issues and bigger principles and bigger ideas. And then on the other end, talking about the very personal side of politics, but not making this a political show. And I last night I was just kind of in my car on the way home, and I pulled my phone out and I was kind of shotgunning a bunch of ideas into using Siri. And I was like, I got done and I was just looking at it and I was like, God, that's two shows worth of material that is just commenting on constant politics stuff and political stuff. Like, I don't want to do that. It's just not what I want my show to be about. But I am going to keep hitting the political stuff, but I'm going to try to find a way to be something a little different inside the echo chamber, so to speak. You know, just kind of try to give you a little something besides just constant commentary. So one thing I want to talk about, so I go on and on and on about Catholic social doctrine, and I really need to start doing more focused research and reading about Catholic social doctrine and start bringing some of that in and using that as the lens through which I comment. Cause I really, the more I read, I'm convinced that that's the lens we have to look through. It's the ones that make sense of both sides and actually calls people to a deeper reality. Cause I don't know. It's the truth. But so let's take an example of this. I want to talk about this. So look, in Catholic social doctrine, they kind of acknowledge reality. And at the same time, they will put out two propositions that are seeming in our context, people act as if they're contradictory or they can't exist at the same time, or there's so much of a rub between the two, you might as well be doing some kind of Zen cone or something, you know? So one of those, two of those realities in Catholic social doctrine are: A, people have the right to migrate, to find work, to feed their families. You know, that there's a basic human right that is a bigger right than it's a human right. It doesn't have to do with the fact of what your religion is or what country you belong to. We exist in this world, and just man before God and nature, you have the right to go where you need to go to find a way to do something, to mix your activity with reality and take value out of that in a way that value can be traded, can be carried back to your family and keep them alive and thriving. Now then, on the other hand, nations have the right to protect their borders. That you have a right to have borders, to have a place where this side, this is your country. This and this, and then on the other side, this is not your country. This is Germany. This is Austria. They're not the same thing. Keep going south. This is Italy. This is Austria. And culture may cross that when you go up in north Italy. The food starts getting a little Austrian. And when you go south Austria, some of the food starts taking on a little bit of an Italian influence because that thing has traded hands several times, right? But there is Italy has a right to have a border and to protect that border and to have this be Italy and that be Austria. Those are two realities that exist side by side. Now, so let's say, now let's take, bring this home and talk about our border, our southern border in particular, because other than coming across the border to pay cash for good health care or to take advantage of the dollar difference on occasion, Canadians aren't exactly streaming into our country. You know, why? Canada's a pretty nice place. Do pretty well in Canada. I mean, they have poutine. Why would you go anywhere when you have poutine? You're like, hey, let's go get, oh yeah, we have poutine. Man, I'm thinking about the beef cheek, the braised beef cheek poutine at, what is the name of that bistro in Old Town Orange? Is it Haven? Is that the bistro? Help me out, Nicole. That beef cheek poutine. Ooh, gravy fries with cheese curds. So good. So on the southern border with Mexico, there used to be a time when it was really normal for the agricultural seasons, like in Southern California, to draw a lot of people up to come pick fruit, to pick vegetables, to work in the fields, do their thing, make some money, and then kind of go back home and spend some time with their families. That was a really normal thing. And now we've got, because of realities of the drug trade and cartels and lots of people wanting to come here and live here and without going through the process out of desperation, usually mostly, I'm not blaming them for doing so. It's become a little different ball game, right? So I was listening to an NPR article the other day or a story on the radio. And, here's one place where this takes, you can kind of look at this. So, okay. If you walk into any dairy, I mentioned this, I think, on the show yesterday with Paul. If you walk into any dairy, you're going to just like hear a bunch of Tejano music. Because like 90%, 85% of the people, like a ton of the people working in American dairies are undocumented immigrants from Mexico and Central America. And why? Well, there's a cap on the price of milk. Government is involved with pricing on some of these commodities like milk. I didn't know that. I didn't understand that. And then on the other hand, there's a X amount of bottom end. Here's how much it costs to keep a cow, keep it fed, get the milk out of it. There's a cost of goods, a cost of production of the product, and a limit on how much you can charge for that product. So that leaves X amount in between. And obviously you're a company, you have to make some profit. So you kind of look at that. That's what I was looking at over the weekend. What can we do with profit margins and payroll and all that? I was looking at all this stuff through the lens of looking at what we can do with this business community that I was working on designing based on just the hard realities of numbers and what the market will bear there. So you can only pay so much. But the work is really, really hard. And so most Americans refuse to do that hard of work for that little money. Great. It's fine. Well, doesn't hire someone can come in and do that work because, you know, it's that's worth their while. That's enough money. They're okay with doing that work for that much money. Cool. All right. There's no work visas. There's no agricultural work visas for the dairy industry. Well, that's just a recipe for someone paying someone to sneak them through a desert someplace and hop a border. So how could these two realities work together? We're talking about Catholic social doctrine. People have a right to migrate, to feed their families and live. People have a right to have and protect a border. Well, okay, great. Let's say we put a big wall up, lock the border down. If you're going to come into America, you have to come in legally. All right, so if we don't change anything, you get some milk and there's not much on the shelves anymore. Because there's dairy businesses going out of business right and left because they have no one to work for them. And so the government's either going to have to budge on the price of milk. Now you go in to buy a cheap gallon of milk and it's $6. Or they're going to have to open up some agricultural work visas for the dairy industry. Right? You see, when you have so many variables, one of them has to move. But here's a great example where these two seemingly contradictory principles, let's look at one particular situation. You can either remove the cap on the price of milk or you can give some work visas. Both of those things could exist at the same time, migration and border. Anyway, let's go to the break. You're listening to The Counterposition. I am your host, Andrew Whaley.
Then all the color glass that painter's palette smash, all the colors of my soul.
If you enjoy listening to Andrew Whaley on The Counterposition, you should become a friend of the show. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show to provide your support. Thank you.
I'm a hyena laughing fool. I'm a hero without anyone to save. Love decked myself in toys. I'm a poor and kingly boy. Oh, I'm lovely. Oh, I'm lovely. And I'm dumb.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley. All right, so we're talking about political reality a little bit. I was just talking about Catholic social doctrine in the last segment and how two seemingly contradictory propositions can be an impetus, can spur us on to ask, how are both of these true? How could that work out? When certain political realities have kind of cast those in the light of a false dichotomy. And I use as an example, the right to migration to feed your family and the right to defend your border and the dairy industry, agricultural work visas, caps on milk for pricing and stuff like that. And just the nature of cost of goods. So there's some reality. So now you have, in that one particular instance, we have to think about, okay, do we want to open up more agricultural work visas and let the dairy industry have some of those? Or do we want to open up this market, let the market be a little freer and let the market rule the price of milk? Now, not to even mention, when it comes to that industry, I won't get on a rant about raw dairy and small farmers and taking regulations off people so they can do something that people have been doing for 10,000 years. But that's a whole different ballgame. All right. So moving on, I want to revisit. I was talking about a story the other day when I was fishing for impromptu guests right before the reading group. I was talking about this, this story about how they found this this grave of a Mycenaean warrior right next to the palace of Nestor on the mainland of Greece, and then in finding that this is kind of set it's kind of reformed our idea of how we think the basis of Western civilization started in the Peloponnesus there in Greece. And they what they saw was a mixture of Minoan culture and Mycenaean culture and a mixture of these religions and political concepts and artistic concepts and everything kind of which they thought that one, these had just been two distinct civilizations. One had kind of knocked the other one out, and then one of them kind of fell down, had kind of got burned out. And then this one kind of picked up, carried that on by after being conquered or something along those lines. I'm trying to remember the exact theory of how it went before, but now why do I want to talk about that? Because what we're seeing these days is that, and so we tend to think that there's like this thing called Western culture. And when we start talking about Western culture, we start talking about Europe, we start talking about Christendom, we start talking about this core backbone of a culture from ancient Greece up until a few years ago that was, and it's what people are kind of worried about being lost, right? Well, you start, people have really cast people who talk that way. They use the phrase alt-right at them a lot because they associate that with the Nazi idea of there being this pure Aryan race, right? And that the race of Europe, this blonde-haired, blue-eyed kind of like pure race is what we're trying to say. Not the case at all. So I was talking to Paul yesterday. There's a book called Who Killed Homer by Victor Davis Hanson. Really worth reading. And he talks about also some basic truths that we used to get in elementary school back whenever we used the Greeks and the Romans as the core of our educational curriculum. And one of those truths is that culture is not blood and blood is not culture. To be a Greek was not, you have curly hair and this shaped nose and you like garlic and olive oil a lot and you have this amount or style of body hair or whatever, this complexion or that's not what it meant to be a Greek. Being a Greek was language and religion and politics and taking part as a citizen and owning land to a certain extent and having some skin in the game, so to speak, having children and progeny and family and being a citizen. Those were parts of that culture, right? That's what made you a Greek, not your blood. We look at, now that being said, now here's what's interesting. What we see is at the very beginning, it looks like, back with Minoa and Mycenaea, there was already kind of a blending of cultures and an assimilation of the best ideas of both kind of coming in. So it's not like, and then of course, when we talk about an idea like Christendom is, Christianity is an idea that is an Eastern reality to a great extent, at least from the Middle East. It is from Israel and the surrounding area of Eurasia over there, and it comes into Europe proper as a movement under the Roman Empire. So even at the core of Christendom, not even talking about what was this Western culture that was underneath the Greeks that was then kind of pushed out by the Romans. So, I mean, look at the clash of cultures we have when you look at the New Testament, right? Pontius Pilate, people like that, they're Roman people. They're Roman rulers. Caesar is the ruler of that area. But the Bible was written in Greek. Everyone speaks Greek and Aramaic. So, in the reality that Christ enters into is this weird intersection between Latin and Greek and Aramaic. Just look at it linguistically. You have three pretty distinct cultures, this Near Eastern Semitic Hebrew culture. The other Near Eastern cultures coming from around there are involved as well. And then you've got the Romans coming in, and this, but they're taking over a culture that had been ruled deeply by the Greeks for a while. So Christianity itself, as it emerges and moves westward and kind of sets itself up kind of its center in Rome, is a mixed reality in the beginning, right? So I guess all I want to say is that when you hear me use the word Western culture and I'm bemoaning the loss of Western culture or whatever, I'm just so you know, I am not talking about some kind of ethnic reality in any way, shape, or form. I'm talking more about Aristotle than I am about blood. I'm talking more about the idea that our senses can tell us something about reality, and that, or that, you know, you can know a thing and you can experience the things themselves through the senses or something. You know, I'm talking about, you know, the ideas of, you know, democracy and freedom and these different things, these concepts, the reciprocal nature between rights and responsibility, or so things that are maybe not uniquely Western, but have a unique importance and a unique kind of set of relationships among themselves in the West. So I was just talking to my friend Ann last night about how what used to get tagged as quote unquote alt-right and what is now beginning to be tagged as alt-right is evolving very quickly. And I just wanted to kind of cry foul, so to speak, for a second. And I just wanted to use this Mycenaean versus Minoan story about this dead warrior and what we're seeing at the basis of Western civilization as this kind of a way to talk about it. I think that there has been a kind of a common, I mean, obviously not a completely homogenous culture, but there's been some common core realities that make our culture Western. That is there's, you know, I mean, there's a lot of different ways to be a Catholic, but there is the faith that was left to the apostles and that was carried out through apostolic succession, and how it incarnated in different ways in different cultures. You have different rites, different emphases of different aspects, different spiritualities, but it's all one faith. Kind of the same way, there are certain basic first principles and certain basic presuppositions about reality that have been played out and gone off the rails and rebelled against each other and all kinds of stuff along the way. But there's a common backbone going from, you know, Homer through the founding of America, or at least, you know, Aristotle through the founding of the United States. Or, you know, I joke like, you know, paraphrasing the Big Lebowski, you know, 2000 years of beautiful, 2,500 years of beautiful tradition from Aristotle to Alistair McIntyre. You know, it's like there is a bead to kind of a line of commonality down that line. And when I use that phrase, I am not talking about blood, just for the record. But I haven't been accused of being alt-right yet. But so when I use the phrase Western culture, I don't mean blood, just for the record. That's not where I really kind of planned on going completely with this. But two ideas merged into one. As happens with me all the time, and especially happens when I do an early morning show. All right. So, well, thanks for coming out, kids. I appreciate it. Drop me a note at thecounterposition@gmail.com. Tell me you're listening. I want to know who's out there. Let's pull the plug, pop the cork on another episode of The Counterposition. See you next time.
I take your place in marble stone. I take your place in marble stone.